This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So I was asked to address how we can make extreme shelter or sites of shelter sustainable. So here is an extreme shelter site. And the short answer to the question is that this isn't supposed to be sustainable. The people who live here are supposed to go home. They want to go home. How do I do this? No?
The right arrow.
Aha, not down. No. The keyboard is not working. It's not my information stupidity.
So left goes forward.
Okay, thanks. Right. They want to go home. And this, in fact, is one trying to go home. This I took in Kosovo. And they're camped out in front of their bombed out house, or their, actually, it might not have been bombed, it might have been pillaged, because people would take the windows out and put them in other houses. So it might have been disassembled in a kind of sustainable, recyclable fashion. Also, just because this gets into all kind of legal issues, it's interesting that the United Nations global law is predicated on the right to return, because ironically, even though all the laws are written in terms of the individual being the seat of human rights, those rights are have to be executed by the authority of a state, because it's the United Nations, right? So to be stateless is actually to lack individual agency. So on that principle and on the principle of this found example, here is a tool to return home. We entered the Architecture for Humanity competition to design a better refugee camp or whatever, but decided that really the thing to do would be to create this tool to go home. Because if the individual can return home sooner, even if there is no large-scale infrastructure, either socio or economic, then it can stop those things from unraveling further, meaning an empty city is one that decays socially, environmentally, much more quickly than one that's occupied. So that a domestically scaled infrastructure that would allow the returnee to squat and rebuild before the city sewer power plant was up and running would be a way to sustain a city. So the place to be sustained is really the site of return. And the way this thing worked, and we're still working on it 10 years later, is that it is, they're hollow columns, basically. They're structural hollow columns. And each one contains a domestically scaled infrastructure. So one would have a cistern, one would have a privy, different kinds of domestically scaled infrastructures. And they would all, but they would also truly be columns. So they would, and you could rest beams on top of them, you could build a floor on top of them, you could basically build the house around them. It would become this kind of disappearing core so that the individual, the bottom-up person, has the agency to describe their own dwelling, but these kinds of pinpoint infrastructures are kind of tactically located. And here's one. Here's our imagined Southwest version of building the house around these things. And here it is, kind of deployed in Afghanistan. And we've been working, there have been refinements, and those refinements, we're still working on it. Like, for example, this one is made out of paper, and it unfolds. So it's much lighter, you can stack them, you can airdrop them. It folds together, it has a different kind of framing mechanism. This is Professor Basili, who helped us develop the paper. That you see on the left, which is insanely strong, and as you see here, it can be filled with insulation, it can be waterproofed, and be covered with all different kinds of materials. We've tried, we've experimented with them in all different kinds of materials that have to do with what's regionally or locally available. Depending if you're on the edge of Burma or you're in Kosovo, and the input for making these refinements. They're the versions we had at the Biennale. One was bamboo, and the other was the paper, and it had a kind of photovoltaic on the roof, actually. Impetus for the way we went about making the refinements had to do with some field work and some time that I spent at the Oxford Refugee Study Center, which is it would be called the Center of Globalization if it hadn't started in 1948. And it is a place where a lot of field workers, international human rights lawyers, legal experts, Doctors Without Borders. It's a kind of center that attracts a lot of these thinkers, and they have these seminars every summer. And I have to say, we've never actually built any of these in a camp. And so I would say my largest success to date was going there and being, in fact, the only architect and having all the human rights lawyers say, "What are you doing here?" And me saying, "Well, women and children are, according to international human rights law, subjects of special interest." "Yes." I said, "Yes." I said, "Well, that's because they get raped when they go collect firewood, and it's a problem when they're not home with their kids and they can't start micro industries." And they said, "Yes." I said, "Well, what if their toilet and their sink and their fuel source were, in fact, in their house? Would that help?" And they said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, then you could really use a couple architects." And by the time I left, it was really amazing because, the guy from Indonesia would come up and say, "I have this problem because the boys, and it's Islamic, and the boys and the girls aren't supposed to go to school together, but I can't get, but I only have a one-room school." I said, "Well, try two different doors." And things like that where it's not, I can't say it was completely grassroots, community-based, but it was still, it managed to intercede with a kind of authority, a level where I feel that it's as effective as I've been. Meaning that just these kind of spatial issues are not always considered in these frameworks. So as you see from the story I just told, that the shelter was also intended to function in the camp, where it would hopefully help sustain or maintain kind of social family structures and rituals of food preparation and kind of physical cleanliness and bathing and cooking, which are really important to the persistence of a culture, rather than subjecting refugees to the totalizing structures of the camp. It would have certain added benefits in that this kind of pixelation, as Teddy likes to say, of the infrastructure would help mitigate things like the spread of cholera, these communicable diseases, because people wouldn't be sharing a spoon that hadn't been washed or whatever. But, and that brings us to kind of this larger issue as I've been having you sit here stare at this just god-awful slide, which is that, that refugee camps are, in fact, eco-disasters. And they have been called thus by the United Nations. That they have, I mean, imagine you have 30,000 to 100,000 people arriving like a flash flood on an unwilling landscape, right, where the landscape is immediately decimated as people search for fuel, and whereupon there's erosion, whereupon there is also the decimation of wildlife and plant species, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as well as the creation of huge amounts of waste and even from the things that are shipped there, because most people are on the dole. And this is even more important, the most important thing is, in fact, they don't leave. They stay. And therefore, you know, increasingly, I would say the shelter even the is not the real issue. The issue is the planning of the camp. And in this case, that core is simply the kind of micro first scale of infrastructure that participates in larger series of planning strategies. And I kind of, for this lecture, decided to call that strategy clustering. I don't want to take too much time. This is pretty interesting if I would go through it, because it's a diagram of the way the United Nations describes moving goods into a camp. I mean, they fly things into huge warehouses, and then they move them into smaller warehouses, and they drive them thousands of miles into smaller warehouses, and then they bring it on a truck, and they hand out those bags that of seed, you know, of rice that you see on TV all the time. But that's the way they think of infrastructural planning at this point. So first is the idea, the first step of idea of clustering is the notion that you take the two columns and you cluster them, right? You make clusters of houses. You make, I think we meant the orange ones to be heat and the blue ones to be waste or water of some way. And in doing so, you start to make these small kind of communal spaces, which might be gardens, which might be protected courtyards. And you start to take that gridded fabric that you saw in the Rwanda photo, and you don't change the rules. You don't change the, you know, kilometers per square foot everybody gets. You don't change the density of the block. You don't change the size of the block. You just change the way things are clustered within it. You know, here's a potentially communal one. And so here we have the four dwelling cluster. Then from that cluster, you have the collection of water, right? And you have potentially, if we can get a little photovoltaic there, the collection of a certain generation of power. If you have a surplus, then those things can be moved and collected in a larger level. So you're actually going from the cluster to a larger scale infrastructure. And I guess I don't have a pointer, but what this is supposed to represent in terms of water is that big dark blue thing would be a huge collective cistern, and that the smaller blue things are smaller ones. Thank you. And that, do I twist it or punch it? Push. Uh-oh, this is mysterious. Which part do I push? I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Aha. This way. Oh, it's a teeny button. Okay. So here's the smaller. Here's these guys, and they feed up to this. This is a somewhat leaky pipe, which is why it generates some green along it. But the other way it could work is if there's drought, it could work the other way. That the United Nations comes, it dumps the water here, and the water gets distributed. So it can be, you know, I'm prepared for the question, top down or bottom up in terms of the way it works. And likewise with the red is supposed to be electricity, you know, which in the, is solar. Yep. I mean, a lot of the, it's a no-brainer that it be solar. That can be distributed or collected. Okay. Yeah. And then this is just for all us old Siam people that, you know, the idea that it would, you know, a leisure valley is the, oh, never mind. You'd have to have been to Chandigarh. They have the seventh way is the leisure valley because it is a way of attracting certain kinds of cultural, institutional events to a thing that is understood as recreational as opposed to agricultural greensward. But you see what the clustering does, because this has the same density as the UN standards. If I put it all together in a kind of utopic way, you get something like this, which is the same size as one of those UN super blocks, but you get moments of intense density, which allows moments of space for planting, for potentially pastoral activities that with these kind of distributed water systems. Now, of course, there's a huge problem with this idea, and that's because the people there are not. They're refugees, and they even though it is promoting the notion of a kind of self-generated clustering, they're lacking all kinds of civil rights. To quote Aaron Levy and Edward Cadava, the title of their beautiful book, "There Are Cities Without Citizens." So that has to be acknowledged within this schema. But the United Nations, honestly, is quite sensitive to that issue. And also to, they're quite interested in both at this point, the environmental problems that these camps create, and also the agency of the refugee within the camp, and trying to find ways, just as we have been talking about in other more normative situations all evening, to create new inventive ways of putting those, using the energy of one to solve the problem of the other. And so now I'm going to show you the last three things I'm going to do is I'm going to show you some examples of kind of what they're doing and what I'm thinking about what they're doing. So, for example, this is Segrain, which was, I mean, if we zoomed in, you'd see it would just look like all the other ones. It was awful. So, but here they didn't do anything while people were there. But when the people left, they recontoured the camp. They made swales, they planted, and they are making a nature center. So they're trying to recuperate that footprint, and, you know, using hay bale. Oh, and they have a library, right? That's then, it's for the people, it's for the citizenry of Segrain, but this is the way they're, one tactic they're using for environmental issues. This one I like even better. This is terracing and planting on the Burmese border, you know, on the other side of the Burmese border. And the thing that I like about this was that it started as terracing within the camp so that the refugees in the camp could plant rice, which is something that they wanted to do and knew how to do pretty well. And also fruit trees. They really like fruit trees. They wanted to plant fruit trees, so they did some of that. And they were so successful that the tribal villages around the camp, which in fact were did not terrace and were suffering from huge erosion problems and were constantly undergoing famine, started to borrow the tactics from within the camp and invited a couple of representatives of the camp who are not UN officials but people from the camp to come to like the town meeting or whatever it was called, and therefore in a certain sense made the boundary between the camp and the larger territory porous. And of course, you know, that is the great promise of whatever we call sustainable or green, and that ecosystems do not obey political borders. And that here they were actually transgressing that fence in order to come to this solution. So I think this is the best, what the UN calls it, lessons learned, that on their website that one can find. But so those are both very, very small examples, though. So the next two things and last two things I'm going to show are slightly grander. This one I think is really interesting. It's the refugee camp of Dadaab. And this is just a little part of it, because there are 300,000 people there, and they've been there for 30 years. It's on the border, as you saw, between Kenya and Somalia. And it actually consists of three settlements, three cities, Ifo, Hagadera, and, well, it doesn't really matter, right? And the thing about them is, despite, you see in this, oh, this is a terrible slide, you can see what's happened over 30 years, that there is some kind of clustering that's taking place. You know, it's hard to maintain that grid over 30 years. But the thing that I find most amazing about this place and made me really want to study it is they won't leave. I mean, you saw what it was like two slides ago, and it's inundated by floods periodically. It's in the news last year because it's all flooded out. They won't leave, and so you have to ask. And of course, there are political reasons why they won't leave. I mean, they don't want to go back to Somalia and get axed, but that's not really the issue. The issue is that they've developed what we like to call informal, but they're really at too large of scale, social and economic systems that persist and have actually changed the kind of larger political geography of Kenya. Oops, I want to go like this one. That's a solar cooker, by the way. But that's a house. Okay, so that's it. So I just very briefly. First of all, it's on the main trading route to Nairobi from Mogadishu. And there was an original settlement. The original settlement of Dadaab is right here. And the Somalis are great traders. They love to trade. They're, you know, some of the people you buy handbags from in New York are Somali. They're really very good traders. And they have set up these incredible trading networks within the camp. Not only within the camp, but for the larger region. And that extend as far as Toronto, actually. Because they have Somali relatives. Some of the people get repatriated to Toronto, and so it just goes global from here. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, the Somali Bantu are great farmers. So despite that landscape, they find ways. They grow mesquite, They grow mesquite. And it turns out the mesquite that goats will eat mesquite. So that there's a kind of pastoralism. It's a weird thing because it's a landed pastoralism, but it's a non-mobile pastoralism at this point, because the United Nations creates a permanent water source. So why should the pastoralists go wandering around Kenya when there's a well right there for most of the year? So Kenya, meanwhile, has been trying to settle its pastoralists, and it can't do it. But they've stopped here. And then let's see. There's one other economy. Let me see what it is. I lost my notes. Nope, it's the past. All right, and then there is also a group of kind of more traditional farmers, who are trying. So when what we did was in we thought, well, there's so much one can imagine, and this is the way it is now, and this big yellow blob was imagining what it potentially might grow to in the next 20 years, you know, that it's not going to disappear. They knock it down and people come and make suburbs around the empty core. So assuming it's going to be there, what would be the kind of more utopic version of it? And so for the farmers, I worked with a landscape architect, Denise Hoffman Brandt, and we came up with a kind of industrialized farming system. It turns out, you know, it's things like watermelon and tomatoes could grow pretty easily here if one distributed the water source. So we kind of said, well, let's move Hagadera, help move Hagadera a little bit down out of the floodplain, but capture those waters and use it. Use the cistern system, the distributed leaky pipe water system you saw on the other slide, and help them to develop a kind of more industrialized agriculture. Then this clearly became a trading city, you know, with markets, and that population might be distributed. And then the third thing was, of course, these circles are the amount, the circle of mesquite that a small herd of goats needs over the course of a year. So that we just try to think, well, what would it take? What would it take to think of Dadaab not just as a kind of urban settlement? And I think the most interesting thing to me about this example, and also about our abstractions, but really about this example, is that it suggests a new kind of agricultural urbanism, or something that is simultaneously dense and extended, something that is simultaneously pastoralist and settled, something that is simultaneously rural and urban, and it starts to loosen up our definition of what the good city is. And you know, and geographers, urban geographers, have many different ways of measuring what a city is. Urban designers, planners, architects are much more narrow-minded. We do measure things in terms of density. We measure things in terms of constant population. But a geographer would look at this, perhaps, in terms of, you know, how much money, you know, what's the economy produced, how many people come and go over the course of a year, and could constitute this as a certain scale of city. How am I doing? Do I have another minute? I have 1 minute. Okay, so in this 1 minute, to me, this is an amazing parallelism. That a guy from this reservation called me because he'd seen the course, and he said, "Gee, you know, I think these might be helpful on our reservation." So I started to look at the reservation, and it was appalling, but incredibly also compelling, the parallelism between the refugee camp and the Native American reservation, in terms of the fact that these were settled pastoralists who'd been denied their land and were now within a contained, arid environment, and were in a 150-year-long battle with the United States government over rights, that the land was polluted, that there was no economy, you know, this is the way it used to be, right? That they had been pastoralists, that it was Bill Clinton went there. So that, you know, that the poverty, that all the things, no water, no electricity, no cell phones, no jobs, you know, very similar to a refugee camp. And that in fact, the proactive strategies of the community-based Native Americans, the things that they were looking at, were very much like the kind of permaculture urbanisms that we saw in the refugee camps. For example, squatting in a tent while you build your house. Well, basically, I just showed the scale is hugely different, though. The little teeny blue dot on my drawing is that dot, you know, so the scale is wildly different. There's a social structure called a posei, which is like a clan of 10 families that tend to cluster at least socially around each other and could be, and would want to cluster physically. That there were alternative crops possible that had not been encouraged. That guy grows hemp. It's illegal, but he grows it in that, you know, and so that you know, this kind of pastoralist farming could come back very easily with bison, and that, so, you know, we had a goat circle. This is a bison circle. This is how big a circle of the bison eat in a year. This kind of planting to stop erosion and also create self-sufficiency for a community that's lacking food was kind of in place. So all these they were developing, since they were off the grid, they were going solar and creating these kinds of home-based solar industry. And trying, therefore, to replace their dependence on collecting firewood. So it's that last thing. So the last bit. The thing I would like to conclude with that I find really amazing about those two examples is this. It illustrates the continuum of the extreme with the so-called everyday, basically, you know, refugee camp, Native American reservation in Dakota. This is the heart of the response to how can extreme conditions of shelter be sustainable, meaning that it's the same question. It's not about the extreme or the normative. That how do you make a slum sustainable? How do you make the city of tomorrow sustainable? Given the persistence of the camps of today are the cities of tomorrow. Given the expanding slum urbanisms, the city of today is the refugee camp of tomorrow. And oddly, the agricultural urbanism, commercial pastoralism, that is illustrated by these examples suggests perhaps an approach to the answer. Okay, thanks.
It works? Okay. Thank you very much, Deborah. So just to finish on this fourth session, we have agent provocateurs David Lewis, down there, and Robert Kirkbride, yes, back there, both from the Constructed Environment School, Architecture and Product Design, as well as Raoul Rickenberg in the front. So we're waiting for your questions.
Thank you. So I have the luxury of looking back over the three previous presentations as well for my question. And I'll sort of give you a warning. It has to do with science and design. Right, the relationship between the two. I was really struck when you started with a statement. They just want to go home, and presumably policy is getting in the way, or politics is getting in the way. But the people just want to go home. And in all the other presentations, there was this notion of there are several things that they share in common. One is sort of fighting the man, right? It's like empowering people, and it's doing it through being very aware of local conditions and participatory design in some situations, multifaceted approaches, social mobilization, that kind of thing, right? And there are a series of things I actually listed if I can make sense of my notes. But I think a couple of them that really stand out are they all had a pedagogic aspect to them, not in terms of formal education, but in terms of empowering people. They embody this notion of emergent behavior, right? Kind of a thought experiment here, I guess. If you if you think about informal behavior as a way of fighting back against whatever sort of formal policy or, you know, whatever might be holding people back, if you flip that around, if you invert formal and informal, and if you think about what you might be doing as being formal, maybe you're working in local conditions, but you're applying things that are somewhat universal, economics, trade was mentioned several times, human needs were mentioned several times, whether it's wanting to go home or whatever it might be. There were several other ones there that stand out. That communication was in the first presentation, Rick's presentation. There was, I believe it was Rick's, there was this great image of signage on buildings, right? So there are these universal things that people do. And it seems like a lot of the empowerment that you're enabling is all about uncovering those what you could call formal, universal, almost modernist themes, right? I mean, they're things that we all do. And it's even though each of the different interventions is local and focused on local conditions, it seems like what each of the four people who are presenting, and including yourself, are doing is uncovering these universals and applying those universals to maybe to sweep aside policy that isn't truly functional or isn't truly doesn't apply in whatever local conditions. So the question there is, that project sounds a lot like science to me. It's about uncovering the state of things as opposed to maybe designing something new. And so I don't know if that's I don't know quite how to.
Well, I mean, I can't speak for everybody, but I think there's a difference between need and solution. That it's easy to say, you know, if we don't eat, we are hungry, but that's universal probably. But the solution to that identification of a need isn't necessarily going to be universal. I pick those last two projects rhetorically to have a parallelism to make the point that what we isolate as the extreme or the odd or the thing that you don't have to think about because it doesn't impact you is the canary in the mine. I mean, that in fact, there's a continuum between extreme and normal situations. So that to look at these strategies which seem radical, maybe they, obviously you're not going to put them in everybody's backyard, but they might start to change the way people think about things. I think that we are trying to get we're, in a certain sense, trying to work against the very modernist, insanely modernist attitude of the United Nations that supplies the same tarp to everybody. And, of course, they do it because it's cheap and because they're working in tremendously difficult situations. But to start to say that each of these camps, in a certain sense, is potentially a different kind of city, right? Or a different kind of landscape is kind of what I'm trying to get at.
I guess just a quick follow-up. It seems as though, I think somebody earlier mentioned the idea of basically templates of strategies that could be exported to other situations. And it seems like these approaches, the kind of things you're talking about, are reduced down, and maybe the reductionism is a problem, but reduced down, they are transferable. And that's where I'm saying, or that's why I'm asking you, is it not just the observation, but the actual interaction is, it's grounded in very basic needs
that's the thing. If you're dealing with a situation like the ones I showed today, which are refugees, the needs are so basic. The more basic the need, the kind of more easy it is to speak about it in universal terms. You know, kind of, there's a certain way that we all know that, you know, our individuation is a luxury. You know, it isn't. It shouldn't be. That's the point. It shouldn't be. It should be there, you know, at all at all times. I mean, those people in those camps were doctors and lawyers and architects, you know, the week before. But we reduce them. And it's because those situations are so dire. I think I like what science can provide. I mean, you know, we're looking at different kinds of paper. I mean, there's different kinds of technologies. Certainly landscape and ecology are sciences, right? So there's nothing, it would be great to be scientific, to have that kind of, truth at your back. But I don't know whether I'm answering your question.
It's a tough question to answer. So I think you are answering.
Yeah. Okay. I want to keep people too long.
All right. Yeah, thanks. I'll try to keep this fairly short. But I'd like to follow up on the notion of the template because, on mm-hmm. the one hand, I really appreciate the thoughtfulness, mm-hmm. Some of the observations you've made in the field, from right. the field, some of the examples, the local mm-hmm. examples you've cited of modest successes. But at the same time, I get extremely queasy with the leap to the formal architectural solution. I see very, very clear modernist solutions where, you know, the Kahn solutions and hollow columns and Trenton bathhouse and certain right. grids that I think are the, it's almost a default solution to make that, to transition that kind of a formal architectural right. template. Regardless where you are in the world. And you used the word utopian a couple of times to represent this kind of ideal. And I think one thing that's missing here are two kinds of scales. One scale, I'd respond to the question of sustainability at both scales. One is considering this on the very, very micro scale of looking at what happens when you say, a hollow column has water, or the hollow column also has human waste in it. There are very, very modest, simple solutions. If you look at Bangladesh, India, different parts of the world where human waste is used in two ways, very directly. First for methane, for temporary energy source, and then for fertilization. So you can actually build micro-industries fairly quickly of self-sustaining systems. So I'd like to see how you actually touch down on the ground at a micro-scale. The second scale is much larger, which is actually taking this less of a template that gets applied architectonically and really follows more what you're suggesting, where some people start to weave local materials into things,
right.
where you district the problem yeah. with the UN and some of these paternal organizations is they do not grow decentralized responses that would be far more rapid given the time constraints right. of crises. And therefore, my question really is, can you develop a template which is less architectonically generated and that develops decentralized, non-colonializing, non-patronizing microeconomies that can become self-sustaining for regional zones of the earth, enabling a more egalitarian dispersion of resources and far more rapid response to crises?
Well, I hope so, because actually that's kind of what I'm trying to do. I mean, first of all, I agree. Partly the reason I say it's utopian is because it's an ideogram, it's a graphic, and it's not what would happen on the ground because the people would have to make it happen on the ground. The idea of the core is that they disappear within the shelter. The shelter is locally determined. There's a huge problem. I mean, we've done a lot of work on, well, why don't you just make it out of the local materials? Well, that's a great way to tear down a forest. You know, there becomes a kind of, it's very complex, the balancing act between what you bring in, you know, what gets grown, and it's going to differ on it, certainly in every temperature level, you know, but it's going to differ culturally because some people do want to make mud bricks and some people can't. So the point is there isn't one solution. It's simply the idea, which I guess got in your mind is overly rendered, that there's this that it they should be thinking about the infrastructure, that it can be domestically scaled, and that's where they should start.
But I think it can also be a little bit more, it can be better planned and coordinated on a decentralized level, meaning that it's not, I'm not saying that you go to each and every site and
right.
build things locally from those materials, which is obviously, you point out very rightly, that's an ecological disaster. But if you plan for this and decentralize it worldwide, then you have regional nodes that also understand the micro-political and cultural situation. So you don't have America just showing up
with a Navy
and dropping things off.
Yeah.
And it's UN, it's Sweden,
yeah.
it's all of these countries who
right.
want to stockpile products. You're inevitably caught, we're all caught as designers, as
right.
these countries trying to reach these solutions, because products fail when they forget the universal, and architecture fails when it doesn't address the site specific. So there's a huge mechanism in there for built-in failure for crises situations like this. But if you actually empower people around the world more regionally to respond to their own sensitive situations, you empower them in a very different way to use regional materials to better prepare.
Hi, that's a good idea.
Thanks, Robert.
No, I mean, it is. But yeah.
Let me see if I can try to tease out, because I really appreciated the tension that you wrote, really, between the issue of extreme conditions and norms,
uh-huh.
that by casting extreme conditions as the norm, you basically reframe the norm as a kind of a permanent extreme condition. And I think that's a really mm-hmm. interesting fundamental issue, particularly, and it's not specific to one place or another. It's actually
right.
becomes a condition in which there is no longer ability to... There's no effectively a go in the go home anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think, and I guess the challenge I would have to you as a mm-hmm. being put in this position of being a provocateur is to say that one of the things that this leads in the thought process is that to frame any site, any camp as temporary,
mm-hmm.
if there is no go in the go home, is to actually perpetuate the problem. I think this is what you're getting at.
Right.
But the tension in this is that in order to then to produce a kind of rapid response, something
right.
that's quick, fast, nimble, and mobile, you produce a situation that is always cast as temporary, whereas the permanency needs to be in place from the beginning in an absolutely fast, rapid response condition.
Right.
I'm wondering if there's any way in which you can present your work in which you no longer cast it as shelter. It's temporary in that
mm-hmm.
sense. In other words, inevitably what you're doing
mm-hmm.
and have to be doing by the framework you set it up
right.
is that you really effectively trying to figure out how to design instant cities that work from the beginning. And I think this is what Robert's getting at
right.
as well. But how do you do so in a way that doesn't produce a kind of top-down model or,
right.
on the other hand, learn from local conditions? And I think the one thing that lingers throughout your presentation that I would, as a provocation,
right.
encourage you to somehow get it beyond
right.
is that you're doing anything even remotely considered temporary.
I agree. I think both of you, I don't disagree with either of you, that the notion that